Good evening, everyone. It's good to be with you tonight. Enjoy that lesson. To think about what David said, the words of my mouth, meditation of my heart, be acceptable in thy sight. That's the things that we say are so important, aren't they? Well, on January the 21st, almost exactly a month ago, we had 5,800 fewer miles in our van than we did this evening. So we put on a lot of miles in the last, and those were obviously in the last, in 3 weeks' time, we put on almost 6,000 miles. And it was a bit of a marathon for us, I will admit. But I wanted to thank you for the many telephone calls and the texts and the words of support that we've got. A lot of people let me know that they're praying for us. And, you know, it made a very real difference in our time. I just really, really felt that. So thank you so much for that. And not only just those, but sent along boxes for the children and boxes for Eunice and I and all kinds of goodies. So thank you so much. Really appreciated that. I said this morning that I was going to speak on the subject of thinking about thinking. And I'm going to still speak sort of about that. But you know how things are sometimes when you start studying, you sort of go off and on a little bit different angle than you thought you were going to. That's sort of what happened to me today. And the subject, the title that I actually have is Blessed Are Your Eyes, For They See, and Your Ears, For They Hear. And that's taken out of Matthew 13, verse 16, where Jesus tells his disciples, But blessed are your eyes, for they see, and your ears, for they hear. For verily I say unto you, that many prophets and righteous men have desired to see those things which ye see, and have not seen them, and to hear those things which ye hear, and have not heard them. Can y'all read this? Is this big enough? Some of you may have seen this before, and some of you may have not. Okay, can you read that? Okay, the words say, "A woman without her man is nothing." Now, some of you may have seen this, as I said. I don't know. I want some help here. What I'd like you to do for me is punctuate this sentence. So could somebody tell me how to punctuate this sentence?
Put a comma after her.
A woman without her. Anybody else add anything else? Okay, men, the ladies beat you to it. Oh, men, was that what you were thinking? Okay, let's be honest. What did you think? Yeah. Okay, that's the other way. A woman. Anything else like this, right? A man will often punctuate the sentence, a woman, comma, without her man, comma, is nothing. Right? Which is obviously a completely false statement, but that's often the way that's the way we'd punctuate it. And the ladies, as I said, beat us to it. A woman, colon, without her, man is nothing. So we have two statements, and I will make no... honestly, I think that we men are more helpless without a man is more helpless without a woman than a woman is without a man. But the interesting thing is what jumps to mind there when we have this statement without any punctuation, And the fact is, it doesn't say anything about, we're not talking about the factuality of the statement. What we're talking about is our perception of what we see when we see the statement. And, you know, it says something about us, what we see as natural in a situation. We say, this is, well, obviously this is it. Well, maybe not so obviously. So how do we know when we're looking at a situation like this and we're asked to punctuate it, that we're seeing the right thing? Because often the other choice never enters our mind. We never even notice this. Why could the disciples see better than those other people who are around them? And how do we know that we are seeing correctly, and that the judgments that we make and the statements or the way we view the world, view our situation, is actually the right way? And I think the key for the disciples was that they had spent time with Jesus. And when we spend time with Jesus, Jesus teaches us to do more than just see that statement. He teaches us to observe and to interpret. And we interpret in the light of his mind. The fact is that we assume our perceptions are reality. We assume that our eyes not only see the truth, but that our minds then give us the correct interpretation of that truth. Back in July of 2008, there was a man and his wife who went camping in Wales. The man's name was Brian Thomas. And while they were camping, or the evening before they went to bed, a group of motorcyclists came up to their campsite and were gunning their motorcycles around there. And they were leather-clad men who just were sort of a scary group of people. And the fact that they scared Brian Thomas and his wife so badly that they actually packed up camp and moved off to another section of the campground where they were sort of off secluded more to themselves. And they set up camp again over there. And later that night, after they had gone to bed and had been sleeping for a while, Brian Thomas woke up to discover one of these men, these motorcyclists, had come back and was in the camper and was attacking his wife. Every man's worst nightmare. And he grabbed him, grabbed this man, and started wrestling with him and trying to fight him. And he was trying to drag him off his wife, and he just was having a terrible time. And he got his arm around the man's neck and started to squeeze. And the harder he squeezed, the harder the man struggled. And the harder he struggled, the harder Brian Thomas squeezed. Until suddenly, finally, the man went limp. And Brian Thomas, at that moment, woke up from a nightmare and realized that he was holding the body of his wife in his arms. Brian Thomas wasn't a completely, well, you say normal. He had health issues, and he had for years had trouble with sleepwalking, and in fact, his wife wouldn't sleep in the same room with him because he would talk and walk around in his sleep, and this is in fact they were having a lot of difficulty with this, and he had been doing extensive medical treatment on this. And they had been so stressed that this is why they went camping. And so this is what, you know, he called the police, and the police heard this story on the phone, and of course their immediate reaction was, yeah, obviously that's a story. They came out there, they arrested Brian Thomas, they hauled him off to jail, and who's going to believe that kind of a story? Well, it wasn't until, you know, after the doctors spoke in his behalf and after his history was given there, that it became obvious that Brian Thomas was actually telling the truth. And he had something called a sleep terror, is what this was called, or what it is called, where something like this actually can happen to people. And halfway through the trial, where he was being tried for the murder of his wife, the prosecution stood up and made the statement that we don't feel that justice would be would be served in any way by sending Brian Thomas to jail, and he's free to go as he pleases. They let him go. But, you know, do we ever do that? Are we ever asleep spiritually? And we think we see the truth. And we think we know where the enemy is. And we think we've got it all figured out. And we go at it with everything we've got. And we wake up and we realize the kind of damage we've done. And we didn't see the truth at all. We were spiritually asleep. It's so important that we protect our spiritual sight. Blessed are your eyes, for they see. Here a while back I was cutting firewood. and I was just limbing the tree. The tree was down and I was limbing it. And as I cut off one of those little branches, a branch came up and just whipped me right across the face. Both eyes. I just didn't feel like I got my eyes shut at all. And just that fast, he had a searing pain in my eyes. And I was very fortunate. It didn't hurt me that badly. But, you know, we get used to everything being safe. We get used to being able to see. And we don't protect our sight. It's so important that we protect our sight. Several years ago, some of you know Pete Schwartz, I guess I'll use his name, who works for us. And we were out at a building that somebody else had built, and the owner wanted a gutter put on it. Well, the problem was that the roof overhang, the metal, stuck out probably 8 inches on past that roof sidewall, the sidewall of the building. And so we had to cut off that overhang so we could hang a gutter on it. Well, it was a pretty long building, 100 foot or so long, and so the way they decided to do it was just to take a skill saw and turn the blade backwards and rip down through there. And so that's what we were doing. And I got up there on the roof, and the noise was deafening. It's terribly loud to do that kind of a thing. And I went over there where Pete was doing this, and he didn't have his earplugs in, completely without earplugs. And I yelled at him. He didn't hear. I yelled at him again. He didn't hear. So I came over and tapped him on the shoulder, and I said, "Pete, go down and get your earplugs." Oh, he said, "It's okay. I'm used to it." Once again, as our perception dulls, we become less aware of the fact that it is becoming duller. Overconfidence in ourselves can lead to spiritual injury, loss of perception. John 9, verses 40 and 41. "And some of the Pharisees which were with him heard these words and said unto him, 'Are we blind also?' Jesus said unto them, 'If ye were blind, ye should have no sin. But now ye say, We see, therefore your sin remaineth.'" How do we know that we're not spiritually blind, that we're not spiritually deaf? Revelation 3, verse 17. "Because thou sayest, I am rich and increased with goods and have need of nothing, and knowest not that thou art wretched and miserable and poor and blind and naked, I counsel thee to buy of me gold tried in the fire, that thou mayest be rich, and white raiment, that thou mayest be clothed, that the shame of thy nakedness do not appear, and anoint thine eyes with eye salve, that thou mayest see." There is a way we can tell. There is a way to spiritual vision, to clear spiritual sight and good spiritual hearing. There's a list of things that I'm sure is not complete, but there's some things that I think are so important. One is the fear of the Lord. The Bible says the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And anything that we do must begin with the fear of the Lord. That should be foundational to our experience. What is the fear of the Lord? There's a lot been written about what the fear of the Lord is. I think for the Christian, the fear of the Lord definitely has awe and reverence and worship. It has a sense of unworthiness as we small humans approach a great and mighty God. I think there's also a certain sense of real fear that should enter into our relationship with the Lord, if we in some way understand Him, we understand the difference between us. Also, I think there's the love of the truth. We must have a love for the truth, and I think if we have that, God will not deceive us. We will never be deceived against our will if we are honestly searching for the Lord. Having that hunger, Jesus talks about having a hunger after righteousness. I think it's also important that we stay alert. Here a while back, it's been a couple years, I don't even know if I told Ron this, but I was going out to put some wood in the fire. And I had missed a call from Ron Schrock. And so while I was on the way out there anyway, I was going to call Ron on the way. And I usually leave the lights off, sort of ironic. I usually leave the lights off outside and I go outside at dark because I love to look up at the stars. They're so beautiful. I like to see it as it is. I don't like to have these glaring lights. Well, I went out down the steps and out toward the furnace, and I was looking at my phone and dialing Ron's number, and I lifted the phone back up to my ear as I walked, and I couldn't see anything because I had just been looking at my phone. And Ron said, "Hello," and I smacked into a tree just like that, just full face. I skinned my knee up and skinned my chin, and then I was supposed to say hello. And, you know, it's a completely bad scenario for me. And, you know, we have to be alert. And we have, you know, I had plenty of light for what I was doing, right? I was reading. But, you know, I was distracted from something maybe that was more important. And that was watching where I'm going. And, you know, sometimes we do something and we say, well, yeah, I've got plenty of light to see. I can see everything just perfectly. Well, are you watching where you're going, though? We can look at the small things and maybe we've got a handle on things on the micro level, and yet maybe we don't have a good sense of the big picture. And you know, there's obviously a lot of lessons in that. One is that I'm not a person of dignity. I never am and never will be. I just these things happen to me. So, but you know, it wasn't the other thing was it wasn't Ron's fault that I walked into that tree when I was calling him. But the fact is, I was a little bit irritated at him when he answered the phone. And, you know, sometimes that also happens to us. We search to blame people for things that maybe they're related to. I mean, I was calling Ron, so, you know, he's linked to this. Well, it wasn't his fault. I should have called him while I was sitting on my recliner. You know, it's not his problem. And yet we tend to blame each other. And that's the easiest thing to do when we suffer from poor vision or when we do things, make mistakes of judgment. We'll seek to blame each other for those mistakes of judgment rather than taking the responsibility ourselves. You know, I thought I had plenty of light, but it was focused on the wrong thing. And sometimes we're so focused inward, just like me looking at my phone, we're focused on the wrong thing, and we end up crashing into a tree, and we wonder where in the world did that come from. Where is the danger? We tend to know or think we know in which direction the danger lies. We think of things, we use terms like the world, liberalism, drift, and we try to protect ourselves from those things. The fact is that the danger lies within each one of us. And it hits us when we're not on guard. 1 Corinthians 2, verse 1, "And I, brethren, when I came to you, came not with excellency of speech or of wisdom, declaring unto you the testimony of God, for I determined not to know anything among you, save Jesus Christ and him crucified. And I was with you in weakness and in fear and in much trembling. And my speech and my preaching was not with enticing words of men's wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power, that your faith should not stand in the wisdom of men." This is one of my favorite verses in the Bible. "Should not stand in the wisdom of men, but in the power of God." There's a huge difference between theory and fact. And, you know, we have to, when we're looking with our eyes, right? But we should be looking through the filter of God, that God gives us. And in the Spirit, demonstration of the Spirit and of power. If our Christian life is built merely on theory, if it's built merely on the wisdom of men, it's going to fall. And we simply will not experience what is there for us, that Christ has for us. But it must be in the power of God. Not with enticing words of men's wisdom, but a demonstration of the Spirit and of power. Not to know anything among you save Jesus Christ. That's another key to truly seeing, is to have Jesus Christ central in our lives. Another key is brokenness. Brokenness and humility. If we are too good to be changed, we cannot improve. And we will not be able to improve our vision. Mark 10, verse 46 through 52, has a story here about a man called Bartimaeus. And they came to Jericho, and as they went out of Jericho with his disciples and a great number of people, blind Bartimaeus, the son of Timaeus, sat by the highway side begging. And when he heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to cry out and say, "Jesus, thou son of David, have mercy on me." And many charged him that he should hold his peace. But he cried the more a great deal, "Thou son of David, have mercy on me." And Jesus stood still and commanded him to be called. And they called the blind man, saying unto him, "Be of good comfort, rise, he calleth thee." And he, casting away his garment, rose and came to Jesus. And Jesus answered and said unto him, "What wilt thou that I should do unto thee?" The blind man said unto him, "Lord, that I might receive my sight." And Jesus said unto him, "Go thy way, thy faith hath made thee whole." And immediately he received his sight and followed Jesus in the way. You want to see? Ask. But you know, humility is necessary for that. We can't have so much pride that we are afraid to ask. And so many times I know for myself that pride can stand in the way of vision, or stand in the way of getting closer to God, stand in the way of spiritual sight. And we're afraid to stand up and shout, because then people will know that we're blind, or that we're not perfect. And so we just sit there, maybe we sort of mumble, "What would have I done if I would have been Bartimaeus? I don't know." People were trying to quiet him down. "Hey, listen, let's not get too noisy about this." He just stood up and he started hollering. And the more they tried to quiet him, the louder he shouted. And, you know, that's what we need to do. Have that brokenness and humility that we're willing to come to God. And a little bit like what Murray was saying this morning with importunity. "If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God that giveth to all men liberally and upbraideth not, and it shall be given him." John 12, verses 37 through 40. "But though he had done so many miracles before them, yet they believed not on him, that the saying of Isaiah the prophet might be fulfilled, which he spake, 'Lord, who hath believed our report, and to whom hath the arm of the Lord been revealed?' Therefore they could not believe, because Isaiah said again, 'He hath blinded their eyes and hardened their heart, that they should not see with their eyes, nor understand with their heart, and be converted, and I should heal them.'" Some people, maybe especially those of a very tender conscience, are afraid that they can be blinded without knowing it. And can we be blinded against our will? It almost sounds like that sometimes. Can we be blinded against our will? Can the truth actually harden our hearts? Well, in a way, I guess we could say it might. We cannot be blinded against our will. I think if we cry out to God to make us see, to help us to see, He will help us to see. But sometimes the truth can harden our hearts if our response to it is to reject it. Habitual rejection of truth will make it difficult for us to see even when we want to. We cannot habitually reject truth and expect truth to be revealed to us, or to realize it when it is presented to us. We have to look. We have to look honestly. We have to be willing to be changed. We have to be willing to let God work in our lives. Seeing is not the same as looking. Hearing is not the same as listening. Luke 9, verses 44 and 45. "Let these sayings sink down into your ears, for the Son of Man shall be delivered into the hands of men." But they understood not the saying, and it was hid from them that they perceived not. They feared to ask him the saying. So many times there are truths right there at our fingertips, and yet we don't see them because we don't really look. We don't really listen. We just see and hear without realizing. Something else that they, there's an interesting anagram here that somebody came up with. W-Y-S-I-A-T-I. Y-C-I-T-I. "What you see is all there is." And we are amazing people for jumping to conclusions. And we see A and C, and therefore we conclude that there's a B. And now oftentimes it's right, but so many times we forget that what we see is all there is. And we can't interpret things that we don't know. Don't jump to conclusions or form concrete opinions based on too little information. It's a sign of shallow thinking when we make a quick conclusion, and then after we've made that conclusion, then we start forming arguments on why this conclusion is right, rather than taking all the information in first. That's another way to put that is confirmation bias. And what we what we think we know, we tend to try to confirm. Who are you really? If you describe yourself, and if somebody else would describe you, or maybe I should say me, if I would describe myself and then you would describe me, we might have two completely different people. And one example of this is found in Matthew 25. When the Son of Man shall come in his glory and all the holy angels with him, then shall he sit upon the throne of his glory. And before him shall be gathered all nations, and he shall separate them one from another as a shepherd divideth his sheep from the goats. And he shall set the sheep on his right hand, but the goats on the left. And then you know how the story goes. He's going to say to these on his left, on his right hand, come, you blessed of my Father, and come in and inherit the good things for you. And he says, one of the reasons that you can do this is because of all these things that you've done. He says, I was a stranger, and you took me in, naked, and you clothed me, sick, and visited me. All these things that they had done. And the interesting thing was that they responded, when did we do this? We didn't realize that we did this. And then he does the same to the ones on the left, except he says it in reverse. He says, I was there, and you didn't do it to me. You didn't recognize me, and you did not do it to me. And then he ends it by saying, verily, I say unto you, inasmuch as you did not to one of these, least of these, you did it not unto me. These shall go away into everlasting punishment, but the righteous unto life eternal. Neither party was aware of their actions. And why were not they aware of these things? It's because they were habits. And habits are really who we are, but we don't think about them because they are us. They're just part of who we are. And the interesting thing about habits is that they always, for something to become a habit in our lives, it was part of our life consciously at one point. We decided to do this, either negative or positive. This is what we are going to do. And we had choice in the matter. And we had a say in the way this was. But at some point, upon repetition, it enters into a different phase of who we are. And no longer do you think of it all the time. It just simply is you. And those things are so important. Hardness of heart is a result of habitually turning away from the truth. And that's why it's so dangerous to turn away from the truth. Because at some point, you develop the habit of turning away from the truth. And eventually, it's not something that you do consciously. And you may not even have control over that. It's just something you do. You are a truth rejecter. The same is also true the other way around. If we are soft to the truth, and if we're willing to take the truth in, then as we do that, and every time that we see, I've made a mistake here, we're willing to accept that, to repent of it, and to move forward, then eventually that becomes the kind of person we are, and it becomes who we are. Habits make up the real you. I don't want to take up too much time here. There's another story that I love in the Bible. That is found in Luke 24. And it's the story of the two men who are on the way to Emmaus after the crucifixion and after the resurrection, actually. I'll just read it. Behold, two of them went that same day to a village called Emmaus, which was from Jerusalem about 80 furlongs. And they talked together of all these things which had happened. And it came to pass that while they communed together and reasoned, Jesus himself drew near and went with them. But their eyes were holden that they should not know him. And he said unto them, what manner of communications are these that ye have one to another as ye walk and are sad? And one of them, whose name was Cleopas, answering, said unto him, art thou only a stranger in Jerusalem, and hast not known the things which are come to pass there in these days? And he said unto them, what things? And they said unto him, concerning Jesus of Nazareth, which was a prophet mighty in deed and word before God and all the people, and how the chief priests and our rulers delivered him to be condemned to death and have crucified him. But we trusted that it had been he which should have redeemed Israel. And beside all this, today is the third day since these things were done. Yea, and certain women also of our company made us astonished, which were early at the sepulchre. And when they found not his body, they came, saying that they had also seen a vision of angels, which said that he was alive. And certain of them which were with us went to the sepulchre and found it even so as the women had said, but him they saw not. A question for you to answer. Did the disciples here have the story right? Were their facts correct? Nathaniel says yes. Anybody else agree or disagree? Absolutely. These were the facts of the story. We have an amazing prophet, somebody who was mighty, had been killed. And the end of the story was there, as far as these people were concerned. They had all the facts right. They had the timeline right. What kind of a story would have you said it was? To listen to these two men say the story, tell the story, would have been a negative or a positive story? Well, obviously, very negative. It's hard to think of anything much sadder. And that's the kind of story it was in their minds. And then it's interesting. Jesus says, then he said unto them, O fools and slow of heart, to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Ought not Christ to have suffered these things and enter into his glory? And beginning at Moses and all the prophets, he expounded unto them in all the scriptures the things concerning himself. And then a little bit farther on, and it came to pass, as he sat at meat with them, he took bread and blessed it and brake and gave to them, and their eyes were opened, and they knew him, and he vanished out of their sight. And they said one to another, did not our heart burn within us while he talked with us by the way, while he opened to us the scriptures? And then the story goes on, and they went rushing back to Jerusalem, and here they discovered that Jesus had been there while they were gone. And the story was completely changed, absolutely changed, from something that was sad and negative and terrible and a tragedy into something. It wasn't a story of tragedy. It was a story of resurrection. It was a story of victory. It was a story of triumph over death and over sin and over the devil. It was a wonderful story. But the chronology didn't change. And those facts that they knew didn't change. Many times we see things, but we don't understand them. And we need somebody to tell us the meaning of what we see. What about our life story? We look back and we say, well, this is negative, this is negative, this is negative. These are all the bad things that happened to me. These are all the bad things that are happening to me. And I think these are all the bad things that probably will happen to me. And you know, we're probably right. But maybe we've got the wrong interpretation. Our story does not have to be a story of sadness and sorrow and defeat. It can be a story of victory and resurrection and redemption and new life. It takes a couple of different things, though. One, it definitely, it takes Jesus to make our lives, make our hearts burn as our eyes are opened. Sometimes it also takes a friend or somebody else to come in and open our eyes for us. And that's why brothers are so important, to tell the meaning of what we see. And that's why it's so important that we have other angles of view. Where no counsel is, the people fall. But in the multitude of counselors, there is safety. And you know, that's an interesting thing. Researchers have found in recent years, this thing of in the multitude of counselors, there is safety. It is so true. And it comes out, it actually plays out very accurately. But there's one thing that can short-circuit multitude of counselors. And interestingly enough, it is, let's put it this way. If I had a jar of pennies up here, and I would hold it up to show it to you, and I would say, okay, let's have you guess how many pennies are in this jar. Well, if Jared would say a number, and then Kendra would say a number, and Anna Lee would say a number, and so on. If we had about five or six numbers, the more people said the number, the less likely the number would be accurate. And that's called correlation of errors. However, if I took this jar, and I said, everybody write down how many pennies you think are in this jar, and then we would average the number that everybody had written down, we would likely be very, very close to accurate. And that's called decorrelation of errors. And the fact is that when one person is wrong, and has and loudly states that opinion, it skews the rest, it skews everybody else. And that's why it's important that we go by, when we look at a situation, that we gauge it in the light of the truth. Gauge it in the light of the Bible, God's Word, and of Jesus Christ. So it's important that we don't correlate errors, but that we decorrelate them. Psalm 40, verse 17, I am poor and needy, yet the Lord thinketh upon me. Thou art my help and my deliverer. Make no tarrying, O my God. The secret to spiritual sight is to realize that we must be fully dependent on the Lord to show us the way, even when we're faced with a seemingly obvious, and when the situation in front of us is as easy as punctuating that sentence on the board, and then we discover that there are more than one way, is more than one way to do that. We must be fully dependent on the Lord to show us the way. The more we kneel, the farther we can see. So let's look around us. There's opportunities all around us. There are positive ones, there are negative ones. If we look for them, they are there. Opportunities to build, opportunities to tear down. One thing I think is important also is that to remember that clear sight requires a clear conscience. Guilt, secret sin result in a skewed perspective. If those things are in our life, we cannot expect to have clear spiritual sight. That's why it's so important that that repentance is a part of who we are as well. Then what are we supposed to do? We're trying to seek sight. And here, multiple times when Jesus was talking about people who said that they saw, he says they don't see. And in fact, they said that they say they see, and since they said they see, then their sin remains and they're blind. Well, should we try not to see then and say that we don't see? Absolutely not. But sight without action helps no one. And sight without action may result in blood on the hands of those who could have done something to divert tragedy. And you can look at Ezekiel 33, verses 1 through 9, and where Jesus was, or where God was talking to Ezekiel and saying about the watchman on the wall, story where if, let's just look at it quickly. Ezekiel 33. I think this is important enough that we should have this in our minds. Again, the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Son of man, speak to the children of thy people, and say unto them, When I bring the sword upon a land, if the people of the land take a man of their coasts, and set him for their watchman, and if, when he seeth the sword come upon the land, he blow the trumpet and warn the people, then whosoever heareth the sound of the trumpet and taketh not warning, if the sword come and take him away, his blood shall be upon his own head. He heard the sound of the trumpet and took not the warning. His blood shall be upon him. But he that taketh warning shall deliver his soul. But if the watchman see the sword come and blow not the trumpet, and the people be not warned, if the sword come and take any person from among them, he is taken away in his iniquity, but his blood will I require at the watchman's hand. So thou, O son of man, I have set thee a watchman unto the house of Israel. Therefore thou shalt hear the word at my mouth and warn them from me. When I say unto the wicked, O wicked man, thou shalt surely die, if thou dost not speak to warn the wicked from his way, that wicked man shall die in his iniquity, but his blood will I require at thine hand. Nevertheless, if thou warn the wicked of his way to turn from it, if he do not turn from his way, he shall die in his iniquity, but thou hast delivered thy soul. If we have spiritual sight and yet do not warn those who are stumbling away from God, or if we don't take that responsibility in whatever way that comes to us, we both lose our sight and we end up with blood on our hands. So let's not put our heads in the sand and just not try to look and just try to avoid the situation. Pray for sight and then pray for grace to minister to those needs that are around us. We should seek to understand so we can understand how to act, or maybe why we should wait. The Christian walk is not a life of, it's not an academic exercise. We're not in an ivory tower. It's a life of discipleship. Okay, I'd like to close with Mark 13, verses 32 through 37. Jesus talking to his disciples about a very specific way of looking. But of that day and that hour knoweth no man, no, not the angels which are in heaven, neither the Son, but the Father. Take ye heed, watch and pray, for ye know not when the time is. For the Son of Man is as a man taking a far journey, who left his house and gave authority to his servants, and to every man his work, and commanded the porter to watch. Watch ye therefore, for ye know not when the master of the house cometh, at even or at midnight, or at the cock crowing or in the morning, lest coming suddenly he find you sleeping. And what I say unto you, I say unto all, watch. Let's kneel for prayer.